And today we're going to have a look at Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamika Karika, the fundamental wisdom of the middle way. And the dedicatory verses are on you if you have minus a bit section. Those dedicatory verses in themselves nearly say what the whole of the investigation of this noble truth, the Four Noble Truths, is. So we'll start with reading it. I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing, unborn, unannihilated, not permanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual construction. So, that's what dependently arisen is. Unceasing, unborn. If nothing is born, there's nothing to cease. Unannihilated, not permanent. So it's only empirically existent or conventionally existent. It neither exists or doesn't exist. It's the middle way. It's not coming, it's not going. Doesn't come into existence or out of existence. And without distinction, without identity. It's only imputed, we only project identities or impute identities onto conventional reality. Everybody quite happy with me? Complete silence there. So whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing and unborn. It's a continuous process of dependent arising. Not ceasing, it never has any permanence and it never stops. It's unannihilated and it's not permanent, so it's only conventionally true. It's not coming, not going, doesn't come into existence or out of existence. So condition called production is no beginning, no end. Everything is just a process of becoming. And without distinction, without identity. What's in brackets, by the way, is just my comment on it. Without distinction, without identity, it's only identity is what we impute, the designation we give to each object. That's the only identity it has. Other than that, it's quite empty.
Cassandra, could you say a wee bit about why it's why the unborn is emphasised? I understand the unceasing a bit more because that seems to imply that something that existed has stopped existing.
Yeah.
But unborn, could you say a wee bit about why you think that's necessary? Because I would have thought that something being born is still redolent of process.
Hadn't really thought on it, but to be unborn, well, presumably that would begin, is the sort of beginninglessness of it. Everything has always just been a process of becoming, it's just been a process of conditions. Okay. And there's never been a thing to be born.
Right. Okay, so it's pointing at the substantiality.
There is never anything that could be born.
Yeah.
There has never been anything of substance. So, what could be born? Although this chapter concerns the Four Noble Truths, it goes much further in that it deals with the nature of emptiness and about the interrelationship between emptiness, conventional reality, and dependent origination. And this is at the very heart of the Milimadhyamika Karika. That's the middle way between existence and non-existence. And the first six verses are a charge of nihilism by an opponent of Nagarjuna regarding this emptiness doctrine. His understanding of emptiness is taken to mean, he's taking it to mean that nothing exists, that there is nothing. There's no dharma, no nothing. So in verse 1, the opponent is accusing Nagarjuna, and he obviously has some, not an understanding, but he's heard of or read or been listened to Nagarjuna's doctrine of the middle way. And in verse 1, the opponent says, if all this is empty, neither arising or ceasing, then for you it follows that the Four Noble Truths do not exist. So here the opponent is saying that if everything is empty, then nothing arises and ceases. Thus, from Nagarjuna's point of view, the Four Noble Truths don't exist. And he says, if the Four Noble Truths do not exist, then knowledge, abandonment, meditation, and manifestation will be completely impossible. In other words, if there's no Noble Truths, then we can have no knowledge of Pratityasamutpada. We can't have any abandonment, any practice of ethics or anything. No meditation, nothing that arises out of it. So, if the Four Noble Truths do not exist, then practicing the Dharma just doesn't make any sense. In verse 3, if these things do not exist, the four fruits will not arise. Without the four fruits, there will be no attainers of the fruits, nor will there be the faithful. So if the spiritual community will not exist, nor will the eight kinds of persons, if the Four Noble Truths do not exist, there will be no true Dharma. So if these things don't exist, that is the Four Noble Truths, the four fruits will not arise. You're not familiar with the four fruits? The four fruits are stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and arahant. They're the four attainments of stream entry, where you become a non-returner, where you have attained insight to the depths that you never fall back from practicing the Dharma, from progressing in the Dharma. A once-returner means that you'll only be reborn in samsara one more time. A non-returner means that you won't be born into samsara again, that you may be born into the deva realm or a higher realm, and from there be more or less certain of arahantship in the next rebirth. And of course, arahantship is enlightenment, synonymous with enlightenment. So these are the four fruits. And without the four fruits, there'll be no attainers of the four fruits. So there'll be no Buddhas, no stream entrants, no once returner. So if so, the spiritual community will not exist, nor will the eight kinds of persons. If the Four Noble Truths do not exist, there will be no true Dharma. So in effect, there can be no truth, nobody attained the truth, and there'll be no Dharma at all, if everything is how the opponent sees Nagarjuna's doctrine as meaning complete non-existence. The opponent goes on, if there is no doctrine and spiritual community, how can there be a Buddha? If emptiness is conceived in this way, the three jewels are contradicted. If there's no true Dharma and no Sangha, how can there be a Buddha? If emptiness is understood in your way, that's Nagarjuna's way, then the three jewels are contradicted. So he's saying that we understand things in Nagarjuna's way, the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, are a complete contradiction. Hence, you assert that there are no real fruits and no Dharma. The Dharma itself and the conventional truth will be contradicted. So that's the opponent's view of, and he's taking Nagarjuna's doctrine of emptiness of the middle way as meaning complete non-existence. Anyone know this view?
That's a nihilistic view, isn't it?
Completely nihilistic view, yes.
It is, but it keeps referring to the fact that there can be no attainment, and we've already decided that the middle way also says there is no attainment.
Yes.
So in some ways it's not in total disagreement with what the middle way says as well.
No.
So I'm confused slightly, that's all.
Well, but what you say, the conventional, I mean, we exist conventionally.
Mm.
So that's what we're talking about, is that it's the conventional you and me that are trying to gain the fruit.
Yeah.
But if it's complete nihilism, then there's no way we can attain them.
Right, okay.
With these are closed system thinking.
Yeah.
You look for the first line. Okay, you always look at the first line, because mistaken closed system thinking can't be found in the middle of it or towards the end of it, because it's set on a faulty premise. So you look at the first line, you go, if all of this is empty.
All
and the first
is
line is wrong.
Yeah.
So it's based on that premise. Yeah.
Right, okay.
If all of this is empty.
Yeah. Okay, that makes...
So in verse 7 to 14, we have Nagarjuna's reply, and he's taking his opponent to task for a complete misunderstanding of the Madhyamaka doctrine. So this is Nagarjuna now, in verse 7. We say that this understanding of yours of emptiness and the purpose of emptiness and the significance of emptiness is incorrect. As a consequence, you are harmed by it. So the opponent's understanding of emptiness and its purpose and significance being incorrect harms him. And Nagarjuna goes on. The Buddha's teaching of the Dharma is based on two truths. The truth of worldly convention and an ultimate truth. So we've gone into this quite detail already, haven't we? The world, truth of worldly convention, the conventional is our everyday experience. And the ultimate truth is the insubstantiality of that. In verse 9, those who do not understand the distinction drawn between these two truths do not understand the Buddha's profound truth. So if you don't understand that, we don't understand the Buddha's profound truth. Without a foundation in the conventional truth, the significance of the ultimate cannot be taught. Without understanding the significance of the ultimate, liberation is not achieved. So without a foundation in the conventional truth, the significance of the ultimate cannot be taught. So if we don't understand the conventional truth, we won't understand the ultimate. We can't even teach the ultimate if we don't understand the conventional. Without understanding the significance of the ultimate, liberation is not achieved. So there's no way of attainment at all if we don't understand the ultimate truth. So the Buddha's teaching is based on these two truths. A truth of worldly convention and an ultimate truth. So by worldly convention, it's meant the truth of our everyday experience, of how things appear to us as human beings. Ultimate truth is how things really are, without the designations and characteristics that we impute to them. Although in these verses it does appear that the two truths are separate, it should be understood right from the beginning that they are interdependent. So to understand the ultimate truth, one must understand the conventional truth, because without it, the ultimate could not be taught. And without understanding the significance of the ultimate, liberation could not be achieved. There's quite a lot in that, then. Is there any problems? So all.
This is the first time all week that I really have. It's the first time all week that I've been totally lost.
Totally lost.
Yeah.
Right.
I think the problem is that the nihilistic view makes so much sense. It makes sense. You need it. It's logical. You know, which is totally thrown me.
Well, why does the nihilistic make more sense and not the eternalistic?
Just because of the way it reads, it's more logical, you know? In the sense that this is the way we think, normally, you know? One and one is two, two and two is...
But you can't have the nihilistic view without the eternalistic view.
But just reading it, you know, just taking it out of context. Mm-hmm. If somebody put that on a table,
right,
and you picked up a bit of paper and said, I wonder what's on that, and you read it, it would make total sense. But if somebody put a bit of paper on the table and it was the Heart Sutra, and you read it, you would think, what? you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm not making a judgmental view.
Sure.
That's just the challenge of mine, isn't that?
I think this is why Nagarjuna does it.
Yeah.
He's presenting what appears to be a common sense, but actually a misunderstanding. So he's challenging us to say, how about this view? And you go, oh yeah. And then he goes, well, no, that's not right.
Yeah.
So I think it's a deliberate mechanism. He's taking something that is appealing, and then he's trying to show how it's wrong.
I think if you take Kulidarani's model of, you go back to the first statement, you go to first principle, if all of this is empty, neither arising or ceasing, then for you it follows that the Four Noble Truths do not exist. So if you go, so the Four Noble Truths do not exist, I think at that point you have to question right there. You have to stop and go, well, do things arise in dependence upon conditions? You know, that's sort of somewhere, I think for me, that's the bedrock for all of that, is conditioned co-production. Because the Four Noble Truths are just a working out of things arising dependence on conditions. You know, suffering arises, you know, because of the desire to have stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you kind of flow into the logic of the nihilistic view if you forget to check out that element of your own experience, you know, because he says here, if all of this is empty, and you're going, yeah, we've been learning that, but you forget to then, when he then says, well, the Four Noble Truths don't exist, it's that, it's going from things are empty to that does not exist. And that's the fundamental mistake, you know, we were looking yesterday about that being a hiding to nothing. You know, that something exists or it does not exist. And particularly when you're talking about principle, truth, to say, well, that doesn't exist, you sort of, at that point, that's where your ears can prick up and go, hold on, pal.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's an absolute denial, isn't it?
Yes.
And actually the whole point is it's not an absolute denial.
It's almost like a cone moment, really, you know?
It's more stuff.
Like a cone moment, you know? I mean, I almost dropped into a fat giggles after we read that.
Just,
it's almost a kind of blankness.
But isn't Nagarjuna saying what you're confused with in verse 10? Without a foundation in the conventional truth, the significance of the ultimate truth cannot be taught.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't understand the significance of the conventional truth, then you're all at sea with the ultimate truth.
Yep.
I mean, you won't understand what emptiness is if you don't understand the significance of the conventional truth. The conventional truth, the emptiness of the conventional truth is its insubstantiality. It is just the fact that it is a continuous flow of phenomena without a moment of permanence. It's the very fact that there isn't an instant of permanence in that flow that is the emptiness of the conventional truth. It is without substance. That is emptiness. So if you don't understand that, then you're taking emptiness as something. But emptiness isn't something.
No, I do understand that. And a thing that struck me when I was reading that was that in the Buddha's day, conventional truth would have been so much different to the conventional truth nowadays.
Stop. It wouldn't. Conventional truth is just the labels we put on it. The labels the Buddha put, it doesn't matter if you put them on in Hindi or Pali or Sanskrit. They're still labels. That's all their designations on to objects of perception. And when you put that label onto it, you've given it permanence. You're thinking, that's something permanent. It's not. It's just a flow of phenomena. The label you put onto it is just that. That's the only identity that that phenomenon that you're labelling has. Mm. It's empty. That's its emptiness. Just the fact that it has no other identity than a label, which itself is dependent.
It's the thing...
What I meant the conventional truth was that nowadays, we've come a long way in terms of physics, chemistry, and various other sciences. So, the conventional truth, unconventional truth, it becomes easier to understand processes and how each and every aspect of the world around us is a process. So, it brings conventional truth and ultimate truth a bit closer together, which makes the difference a bit more subtle. Does that make sense?
I see what you're getting at. That with science as it has developed, especially quantum mechanics, perhaps, that you can start thinking that you can relate that to the Dharma. But the Dharma stands on its own quite without any idea of the sciences, modern sciences. And it doesn't change it, really. It all comes back down to just the fact that we label things, we give them designations, we make substantial what is insubstantial. That the emptiness of it is just that insubstantiality of that is within the flow of phenomena, the dependent arising. Everything arises in dependence. You have a phenomenon as a condition, dependence in which a phenomenon arises in the very instant it is arising, it's a condition. There's no substantiality in that flow whatsoever. That's its emptiness. Conventional reality and ultimate reality aren't separate. Emptiness is just how conventional reality is. It's insubstantial. Empty of anything fixed, any inherent existence, any essence.
I mean, I think intellectually I understand that. The problem we've got is take it that step further. To intellectually understand it, experientially, I don't, you know, and that's kind of, that's the crux of what I'm trying to get at now, and that's the lifelong learning that we're involved in, really, you know,
yeah,
taking that from intellectualization to truth within your being.
With, I mean, examining your own form, the flow of your own form doesn't help in any way?
Or it all helps.
Looking at a leaf and realising that it's not a leaf, it's just leafing.
But, I mean, for me to understand that fully, I would have to be enlightened. And I'm not enlightened, so...
I think there's a step, you know, there's a step here. Without the foundation in conventional truth, it's a difference to what possible truth cannot be taught. Well, it can't be taught in that you're using conventions to teach it. But also, unless you can see the conventional as convention, you know, when we sort of designate, you know, we all the time we're kind of designating objects and labels onto our experience. And one of the things I think is really important is to be able to see that they are conventional. So that is the conventional truth. The conventional truth is knowing that convention is convention. Once you know that convention is convention, then you've got some chance of starting to see that actually what's behind that is emptiness, and the emptiness itself is empty. Until you've really taken a ball that's convention, that what you're perceiving and working with is convention, you're stuck in abstracting ultimate reality. You know, because it's something else. It's not your perception you're dealing with. It's an idea that you're dealing with. So you have an idea of reality. And I think that's, for me anyway, in my kind of attempt to understand this, that's the important step about the conventional truth, is first of all, it's recognising convention is convention. So when I'm using constructs, I'm all the time trying to call back to mind that it's a conventional construct, rather than allowing myself to unconsciously absolutise it, and therefore abstract myself from the overall situation. But I mean, I do think, you know, we're dealing with enormously strong habits to not do that. Otherwise we wouldn't be an enlightened beings, would we? So, you know, I think the fact that it's confusing and difficult is only just off the course, really.
It's the perception, it's the fact that I'm dealing with perception instead of concepts.
Well, I think, certainly the way I try and relate to this, is like, I try and understand it as a concept, but then I've got to bring it into my own orbit. I've got to bring it into the perceptual sphere, and the sphere of my own sort of direct experience. But that's just, you know, that's just how I can tackle this stuff. And then if I find myself here, you know, in a particular sort of place in my mind or my meditation, it's like, well, what's happened there? What am I thinking about? How am I thinking about these things? How am I reifying the situation? How am I making it real? So trying to look at what I'm doing, what assumptions I'm bringing.
It's really getting the gut feeling of it you're looking for, rather than the intellectual understanding of it. Take it into yourself,
life,
just in
the way. Yeah. These things for years,
that was quite an important bit to get a grasp of that, to get an idea of it. Any other? Everybody else is quite...
I think Eddie's speaking for us all, really.
Yes, the spokesman.
Okay. Nagarjuna goes on. By misperception of emptiness, a person of little intelligence is destroyed, like a snake incorrectly seized, or like a spell incorrectly cast. Nagarjuna is accusing his opponent of being destroyed by a misperception of emptiness, since he is interpreting the emptiness of phenomena as non-existence, as nihilism, when nothing could be further from the truth. There is actually, far from the truth, it's the opposite from the truth, actually, if you interpret emptiness as nihilism, which will probably find out as we go along. For that reason, that the Dharma is deep and difficult to understand and to learn, the Buddha's mind despaired of being able to teach it. You have presented fallacious refutations that are not relevant to emptiness. Your confusion about emptiness does not belong to me. For him to whom emptiness is clear, everything becomes clear. For him to emptiness is not clear, nothing becomes clear. So the Buddha's teaching is deep and difficult to understand. The opponent has presented fallacious refutations that have nothing to do with emptiness. His confusion about emptiness is not Nagarjuna's teaching. And now we're coming to the next part of Nagarjuna telling us how it really is. So from verses 15 to 19, Nagarjuna explains the interrelationship between emptiness, conditioned co-production, and convention. He says, when you foisten us all of your errors, you are like a man who has mounted his horse and has forgotten that very horse. So when you put all your errors in us, you're like a man who, in counting his horses, forgets the one that he's mounted on. This is like the opponent who's mistaking Nagarjuna's analysis of emptiness as nihilism, when it is his own view that is nihilistic. And Nagarjuna's not only saying, you're wrong, it's not nihilism, it's your view that is nihilistic. If you perceive the existence of all things in terms of their essence, then this perception of all things will be without perception of causes and conditions. If things had an essence and were unchanging, then they would have inherent existence. This was the view of the opponent. However, if this were so, then things would be without causes and conditions. And in verse 1, I think it was, when the opponent denies emptiness, it means that everything is fixed, reified. In other words, he's saying they're not empty, they are existent, they have inherent existence. But if things were not existence, if they weren't empty, they would be fixed, unable to change. With his view, things would not be able to change at all. He would have reified them when he denies emptiness, the opponent. Okay? But this verse seems to be of two meanings. The opponent view reifies things to maintain their conventional reality. And by so doing, he denies any kind of dependent arising or action. But on the other hand, if Nagarjuna's view of emptiness meant complete non-existence, that would reify emptiness, and there would be no conventional reality. These are the two extremes, and both are saying that to exist is to exist inherently. One, the inherent existence of the convention, and the other, the inherent existence of the ultimate. But Nagarjuna denies those two extremes, and he argues a middle path which reifies neither conventional reality nor emptiness. Therefore, it follows that emptiness is empty. To exist is to exist conventionally. Thus, phenomena and their ultimate nature, which is emptiness, exist in exactly the same way. If all things had an essence, if all things had inherent existence, that is, if we reified them and made them into fixed things, then both conventional and ultimate would be impossible. If they were in existence, they couldn't go out of existence. If they hadn't yet come into existence, they couldn't come into existence. Things would be reified, they would have inherent existence, they would have a fixed essence, and couldn't change. And that applies to both, he's saying that applies to both conventional reality and ultimate reality. He's saying nothing exists at all, you know, that's emptiness. Then you're reifying emptiness. You're making it into, you're giving it inherent existence, an essence, fixed. And if it was that, it couldn't change. So there could be no conditioned co-production. There could be no dependent arising.
think the thing is that that does... we do see the consequences of that view, though, don't we? In terms of people who are, on the one hand, fully assenting to saying, yes, I'm practicing a spiritual path, but on the other hand saying, well, this is not necessary and this is not necessary and this is not necessary because ultimately it's empty. So you do get that, you do come up against that, and I think that's just a manifestation of this, isn't
it? Sure. Well, it's a misunderstanding of emptiness. Mm.
This is the resolution, as far as I can work out. This presents the resolution between the developmental approach and the spiritual immanence approach. It shows how those two things are in fact the same.
Mm.
And it shows how those two things work. You have to have the developmental path.
Before you can
have it. This is the evidence for the developmental path within the context of spiritual imminence. And it's very, very good.
I don't want to hammer the nail in too hard, but okay with this. Because this is, we're getting to the real, real heart of whole of Nagarjuna's doctrine of the middle way.
I suppose it would be okay because, you know, in terms of it's just sort of skimmed across the surface for me there. And it's just like, but actually how to take that in and just really and sort of mulch it backwards and mulch it forwards, you know what I mean? And really make it in. But at the moment, yeah, I would say, yes, it's provisionally okay, but actually there's a whole level of not quite taking it in yet.
But it'll soon be ultimately okay.
I don't want to go for ultimately, I'm just thinking, you know, beyond.
Conventional
plus. Epidermis,
beyond epidermis.
Now, verse 18 could be considered to be the very heart of the whole thing when the Nagarjuna says, whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. That, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. That is emptiness. That is emptiness. Being a dependent designation is itself the middle way. Let me read it again. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. Emptiness, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. Something that is not dependently arisen, such a thing does not exist. Therefore, a non-empty thing does not exist. I think I mentioned that yesterday.
I've heard the terms conditioned and unconditioned.
Yeah.
How does that tie in with?
Well, it doesn't. conditioned and unconditioned. Did we not say something about that right at the beginning? Anyway, without going into a great deal, just take the unconditioned as meaning it's not conditioned by greed, hatred and delusion. Don't take it as meaning anything further than that. In the Abhidharmic doctrine that we examined in the course of studying the Harp Sutra, when they examined and investigated the skandhas and tried to reduce them into their ultimate existent constituent parts, and they called these would have had inherent existence. These were the unconditioned in terms of the Abhidharmic view. But the Heart Sutra and the Perfection of Wisdom and Nagarjuna denies that. So don't take the unconditioned as being something in itself. It isn't a thing at all. It is that which is not conditioned by greed, hatred and delusion. I think that's the best interpretation as far as the Mahayana is concerned, of the unconditioned. So, in verse 18 especially, the gardener is firmly establishing the middle way, which is at the very heart of the Madhyamaka philosophy. This is the relationship between emptiness, dependent origination, and verbal convention. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is emptiness. And that, verse 18, that is equal, you know, equal emptiness, is a verbal dependent conventional designation. Emptiness is just a verbal dependent conventional designation and is itself the middle way. The significance of this is that emptiness itself is empty. Thus the phenomenal world and emptiness are not two distinct things.
It's so neat, isn't it? Because I mean, neat as not as an American neat, like neat and tidy. Because that verse just totally stops you from thinking emptiness is this thing, you know. And you know, like you were talking back about bringing things into our experience, because it's so easy to just think of this is the world and then there's the emptiness, you know, and just to think that this stops you from doing that.
It's very much sort of rooted in our experience. It's quite mind-blowing just how he's gone through this, and then there's your verse. And that's...
It's
pretty
hard to think about how the word emptiness came about to describe this theory, you know. I think it was said in one of the groups that it's quite an unfortunate word.
Well, some people seem to find it. I think it's just a perfect word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Emptiness. It's empty of substance.
Mm-hmm. See, when I think empty, I think it's got an analogy about an empty paint glass. You know, nothing like that.
You have to get the idea that emptiness isn't anything at all.
Mm.
It's just how a phenomenon is, how the flow of phenomena is, that it's empty. You know, it's got no permanence whatsoever. It's empty of anything, of an essence, of inherent existence.
You rang a bell there, actually. You know, emptiness. Emptiness. Even the word empty, the definition of the word emptiness, nothing at all.
That's right. That's exactly what we're saying. That's what that verse is saying. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. Emptiness, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. Nagarjuna puts it down as whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. That, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. But you can substitute emptiness for the second that, and it seems a little bit clearer. Let's read these two verses again, and I'll substitute emptiness for that so that it seems a little bit clearer. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. Emptiness, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. Something that is not dependently arisen, such a thing does not exist. Therefore, a non-empty thing does not exist. And Nagarjuna is firmly establishing the middle way. This is the relationship between emptiness, dependent origination, and verbal convention. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is emptiness. Emptiness is a verbal dependent designation and is itself the middle way. The significance of this is that emptiness is itself empty. Thus, the phenomenal world and emptiness are not two distinct things. You could say that two attributes are characteristic of each other or of the same thing. Every dependently arisen thing depends on a verbal designation. So the identity of every dependently arisen thing has no self other than being the referent of its designation. Apart from verbal convention, the thing itself has no identity. To understand emptiness in this way is to understand it as neither a fixed entity or as unreal. It is conventionally existent, but ultimately empty. This is the middle part of emptiness. In 19, Nagarjuna is making it very clear that there is nothing which is not dependently arisen, and that includes emptiness. Therefore, a non-empty thing does not exist. So, every dependently arisen thing depends on a verbal designation. So, the identity of every dependently arisen thing, that's everything, has no self other than being the referent of its designation. Apart from verbal convention, the thing itself has no identity. To understand emptiness in this way is to understand it neither as a fixed entity or as unreal. It is conventionally existent, but ultimately empty. This is the middle path of emptiness. And Nagarjuna makes it very clear that there is nothing which is not dependently arisen. And that includes emptiness. Therefore, a non-empty thing does not exist. This is the very heart, actually, of the whole of Nagarjuna's doctrine. This examination of the Four Noble Truths is perhaps the most important of the 27 examinations that he makes in the Mulamadhyamaka Karika. This idea that emptiness, the designation emptiness itself is empty. Other than that designation, nothing has any other identity. It's only by its designation that we identify anything. But that designation is empty. So the emptiness is empty. And we certainly absorb this in reflection today. Just reflect on the emptiness of emptiness.
Is there no sense of having been sold a pup before and that this is the real deal? Do you know what I mean? Not that the Heart Sutra is a pup, I'm not suggesting that. But I've been, and I don't know, it's something that I've always been in study groups and looking at the emptiness of emptiness. I go, yeah, whatever. You know, and the emptiness of conditions. I've never felt like this before. So I just feel this is, I'd really like to take this over and over again.
Well, the comments I put are a very brief comment, leaning heavily on Jay Garfield's comment, which is dense, difficult. Jay is J-A-Y. It's not an initial, but J-A-Y. Garfield. In his foreword, he says he is a philosopher writing for philosophers, not for Buddhologists. So there's a lot of stuff in it that is. In the middle way is the emptiness of everything. I mean, we're taking the Four Noble Truths, but you can take any formulation of it. You can make a formulation out of anything at all. Everything is dependently arisen. So if the Four Noble Truths is dependently arisen, you know, this arises independence and that arises independence of the fallen. You can take anything. You know, a tree is dependent. Your dinner is dependently arisen. Well, I think this is quite a good place because we've got to the sort of heart of Nagarjuna's doctrine there. But anything else to chew over on what we've got today? Anything that...